Carol Ofori, East Coast Radio.
It is KZN's number one hip music station, and we've been having a conversation around men's mental health, and we've unpacked various conversations, and most of it stemmed from a riveting book. The book written by Dr. Mzamo Masito is one, and he is one of Africa's most influential voices, a business strategist, a cultural architect, a leadership expert, and now acclaimed author with this book called This Country Hates Our Men/Boys. I have Dr. Masito on the line right now. Doctor, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Oh, so your book and its title, absolutely riveting, some may say provocative. I recall you even mentioning that someone on a plane said to you, why that book? Why that name for the book? What experiences and realities led you to this really bold, provocative title?
There are three in the main reasons I ended up writing the book, but also choosing this title. The first reason really is I have two brothers who passed away. And the first one, I call him my brother's keeper, really loving brother, an amazing man. And he really took care of me. And I was one of those kids who I am not physically fluent, which basically means I can't fight at all. Like I lose fights. And yes. But my brother, but I was very verbally fluent, very verbally smart. I had a mouth and I could start fights, but I won't be able to end them. And my brother will step in and end them for me. And he never asked whether I was right or wrong. He was just my brother's keeper. Then also he married and was an amazing husband, an amazing father to his son, my nephew, present. And he used to say to me, whether I'm employed or not employed, I would live under the bridge with my son and my wife if need be. But I'm not abandoning anyone. And I won't do what was done to us by our fathers and carry that curse. So I wanted to honor him because that's an amazing masculinity that the world no longer likes to talk about. And the world talks about a masculinity that is only toxic, only trash. And I just wanted to say, hey, by the way, here's a man I grew up with, a case study of someone who takes strangers to his house and house them for 3 months. And I get to his house and I ask him, who are these people? He's like, no, he was in need. I'm helping them out. They'll be gone for a week and they're there for 5 months. And I really adored him and I loved him, and he passed away from kidney failure. And I also wanted to reflect on the issue of health, and particularly black men and health, black men and obesity, black men and umkhaba, which we see as a signal for wealth or prosperity, but it's also a signal for heart attack. It's also a signal for kidney failure. And it's also a signal for erectile dysfunction. So it's a signal for many other things that we medically don't talk about, but we only talk about the part that says you are making progress. So that's the first brother. The second brother is my older brother who passed away, who committed suicide. He hanged himself and he hanged his son, my nephew, 8, 9 years old. And he left me a 2-page suicide note. And I wanted to understand why men complete suicide at 4-5 times the rate. And also, I mean, the recent stats show that 80% of completed suicide in South Africa are by men. And I wanted to understand that. And because he left me this 2-page suicide note, and I really wanted to understand it. But also as an panelist and an academic, a behavioral scientist, I went to go read and better understand why do men complete suicide. So at least so that I can help explain it to myself, but also help others understand the why. And then the other second reason, other than my two brothers, is me. I grew up without a father. My father abandoned me when I was less than a year old. When I was constantly in therapy and they were asking me to write my adverse childhood effects, I could see now in my adulthood how the abandonment wounding by a father plays out in your adult male experiences and how you show up in the world. And also, secondly, I had a stepfather who was present but very violent to my mother, intimate partner violence. So I grew up in a very dysfunctional, violent home. And I wanted to understand that as well, how it shapes a boy And the man you become if you grow up in a very dysfunctional, violent, intimate partner violence home. And my stepfather was an amazing father to me, but he was an abusive husband to my mom. So that also I wanted to reflect this this dialectical view of a human being, which is very much like amazing father, abusive husband in one person. And so that I see him in his entirety, not just one-sided story of an abusive husband. And so that was the second theme. The third one was just me running an NGO for 21 years called African Men Care. And in that NGO, we democratize opportunity and increase transcendence for young boys and girls. And I started noticing 15 years ago that the boys were falling behind and failing at school. And I started noticing from grade R all the way to grade 4, because we fund and sponsor kids from a grade R all the way to university. And I started noticing they were falling behind in grade R to grade 4. And then when I went to look at the data, and I saw that the data confirmed my hypothesis that boys were the ones who were doing the worst in grade R foundation phase on reading for meaning or reading comprehension and mathematics or numeracy or science. They were the ones also who had the highest absenteeism, the highest late to be at school. They also in grade 10, they have the highest dropout rate is boys. And in grade 12, less than 44% of boys wrote grade 12 on national senior certificate, even last year alone. And at university, I started observing that the graduates, even in my own NGO, over 60% of the graduates were girls or females. When I went to confirm that with the data at universities, and I started noticing the same pattern, that even at universities, the highest number of graduates are predominantly female. So I wanted to understand this. And then there was the word hate comes from the research, listening to young boys basically saying to me, uncle, when boys are asked, when I say masculinity, when I say the word masculine, what comes top of mind? And there's even global research that was done for 12 to 18 year olds. The first word they use is toxic. And they said, masculinity is toxic. That's all we hear. And we don't hear anything nice. We feel like we're being hated. We feel like we are a thorn and a pebble in society's shoes, and we are a problem. We've been problematized as a problem at a young age. We feel like we didn't invent patriarchy, but for some reason we are inheritors of a system that is, we are told it's toxic. Therefore, it makes us toxic and all of that. So, and they also use words like the boys who don't have present fathers at home, they will hear their uncles or grandfathers say, oh, Nailenja. And or they will hear someone says, your father is useless, or you're just like your father. And there's a lot of verbal hate in this country that we like to focus a lot on physical violence, and we really focus on verbal violence, or what we also call relational aggression. And actually, that kind of verbal violence and relational aggression is as hateful to the brain as physical pain. The brain doesn't distinguish between physical pain and semantic pain. And I wanted to make this clear to society that to say that I don't hate boys, I hate men, is also flawed, because no man grows, is born a man. Men are born boys who become broken boys with broken interiorities, who then become broken men who break society. So I just wanted to reflect on all of those things. And so the title, I didn't want to sugarcoat the problem, and I didn't want to sugarcoat the crisis, because as Dr. Clementine said, like in one of your interviews, that we are not having a crisis, or we are not going to have a crisis. We are actually in a crisis. So I wanted to increase the urgency and bring this to the awareness of policymakers, of government, of parents, of the community, that we are leaving the boy child behind, and he is failing and falling behind, and men are struggling. So that's really the essence of it.
Yes, no. And I can hear that, it's a collection of experiences, a collection of lived experiences and other experiences from other boys and men that you've spoken to. What has been the biggest lesson for you after writing the book that you've taken from this experience?
The first one for me has been this thing that society lacks dialectical maturity on. If I say to society the boy child is failing and falling behind, some people, what they are hearing is that I am either blaming women or blaming women as the cause of that fall or failing, or I am now trying to insert men again into the story while we still have major challenges on gender pay gaps, gender inequality, gender-based violence. And what I've learned over time now is that we are a society that has either or, that but does not embrace and. And what I'm arguing actually in the book is I'm arguing for gender equality is not a zero-sum game, and that gender empathy is not a zero-sum game. We can empower girls and women while also empowering boys and men. It doesn't have to be either or. And that's one of my biggest lesson on this has been the attack has been mainly that men must step aside and boys must step aside. It's women and girls' time. And my argument is that's short-sighted, because in the long run, the same problems we are having now, they will amplify or multiply in the long run if we leave 49% of the population behind and only focus on 51% of the population. It might be good now in the short run, but it won't be in the long run, because there will be more violence, more gender-based violence, more femicide if we leave these boys and men behind and they feel emasculated and they will bleed on the people who did not cut them. So that's been the one that's been interesting for me, that we seem to struggle to hold multiple truths. We struggle to hold multiple opposing truths, and we struggle with dialectical maturity, that we can do both, and it is and, it's not either or.
It's not either or. Your book title also says, "Boy, you are on your own." That was obviously intentional, and what did you mean by this?
I actually, one of my role models is Steve Biko, and Steve Biko writes the book, I Write What I Like. And in it, he references the idea that black people or black men, you are on your own. And I stretched it because I love Steve Biko a lot, and he's kind of my top role model. And the idea really behind it is that I am basically saying to the black boy that, hey, wake up. You also have agency. You also need to step up. And you also need to figure this out and not wait for society to join you. Society will join you, but at the moment, as things stand, it looks like you are on your own. And it looks like if you also on your own don't step up, you will truly be left behind. So at the moment, as things stand, with all the data that I've presented, you are on your own. And that's the literal part of this whole thing, that you are on your own, because the focus on the boy child has truly been less and unintentionally. And I say this always, that I don't believe that anyone intended it to be so. It was unintentional, but it has produced the results that it is producing. And I wanted the black boy in particular, and colored boy, because I cut this by race as well, because the race that is severely affected by all this data that's coming out in the data is predominantly colored and black. And I wanted to make that also clear, that this data cuts across race, class, postal code, where you were born, and whether you have parents at home or not, your parents' education levels, all those things also matter in shaping a boy. So the idea that boy on your own is really twofold, which is you're on your own, so you have agency. Also step up. And genuinely, you are on your own. It seems like you've been left behind.
Right. Now, I did speak to Dr. Chawani, psychiatrist Dr. Chawani, about an article she wrote on the back of the release of your book. And one thing we talked about is how a man's worth is put on financially what he can provide. And then second, it would be protect. And then lastly, it would be love. It seems to be in that order, to a point that even when I've had these discussions on the radio, overwhelming amounts of men believe that their real impact in society, in their homes, and what gives them worth is what they can financially contribute. What do you say to this, with this particular narrative, and how it affects men's mental health?
Currently, it is how men feel and how they have been assessed and judged by society. For example, there's two things that men would say, like in Nguni words, or even in Xhosa, people would say, "Ilizwi lendoda engenamali alivakali," and which literally translates like a man without money, a man's voice without money is faint or just not heard. And then the second part, men will say that no one checks up on a man to see if he is okay. They check up on a man to see if he is still useful. And these things are hard for men because our masculinity social construct of the last 1,000 years or hundreds of years has been designed and defined around provision, around protection. I would even argue that not love, because majority of men argue that they don't know love. They know the word respect, and they feel maybe loved when they are respected. But the word love itself, they don't know. They feel like they are love stunted. So that also adds. Now, in a country that has 65% youth unemployment, that has over 20 plus millions of South Africans on social welfare, that has high levels of unemployment, and there's now a growing number of men who are not, of males, who are not in employment, not in education, not in training. This old masculinity social construct is now injuring men physiologically, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally. So it's actually a construct that now needs to be revisited. And we need to find new ways to define what it means to be a man beyond provision and protection.
And if you had the opportunity to unpack this, what would you say it would mean? Because when I asked Dr. Chawani, she mentioned how a man needs to understand that he is more than just a provider. He is someone's dad who needs love, who needs attention, who needs time to spend with children, with his family, with the ones that love him. And that is valuable to the ecosystem, especially in the times that we live in now. If you could give a construct to say, fine, we agree that putting your worth on value, as in financial, what you can bring, is definitely not someone anyone, especially in the world we live in, can put value on in life. What would you say men should start looking at that will start changing perception, but also that will be accepted by society? Because society still sees this massive tag that, like you say, you're either useful or useless.
I think you must all accept that men are not in an island. Men are also social creatures who are coexisting with everyone else in this island called Earth or planet Earth. So men won't be able to do this on their own. Let's start there first to say that men, it takes a village to create a whole human being. And therefore, men also need their allies, which means they also need women to help them with the redefining of what it means to be a man beyond provision and protection. So they do need the XX chromosome partners, and the XY chromosome needs the XX chromosome part. So let me start there. We need a village first. And then the second part for me will be, at a young age, boys need to be hugged more, because boys are not hugged. By the time they turn 4, every parent, including mothers, including fathers, they'll be like, no, prepare him to be a man. No one is preparing boys to be great, decent human beings first, who happen to be XY chromosomed. The idea that we should first be great human beings. So it should be embedded young, who are you, beyond provision and protection, not when you are now a tree that's fully grown. We say in our cultures, umti ugotywa usemncinci, which is you bend the tree while it's still young. And so how can you now want to bend a tree that's already fully grown at age 40? And you say to a 40-year-old, come on, be vulnerable. How can he have tools to be vulnerable when he was not thought to be vulnerable, when he lacks words with emotion by the time he turned age 6? So the best things we have to do early are, what do we do at early childhood development, at foundation phase for a child, at home? How do we make sure that the child has a vocabulary, especially a male child, enough expansive vocabulary to be able to name a feeling, to name an emotion? Then when we get to school, I like what Dr. Gianni used to say, that the school focuses on churning out a male to be a laborer, a thing, an object, not a subject. So a child at a young age, a foundation phase, we are already spending time in them, their masculinity being performative in doing, not enough time in the first 2 or 3 years, no exams, nothing, but who are you? Who are you? Who are you beyond the performative masculinity, the doing masculinity? We don't spend time in life orientation at foundation phase, focusing on the male ball on who are you? What makes you you beyond provision and protection? So we skip all of these steps and we focus immediately on the doing, which then makes it hard for men to be able to answer this question, who are you beyond the doing, the protection and the provision? Because we haven't equipped males with that language. We haven't conscientized them beyond the doing, the protection and the provision. So mine, I would say, like, really, we need to bend the tree when it's young, and we need to start there at home. And we need to extend it to the education curriculum.
Absolutely. And you touched on masculinity. And of course, the most popular phrase is toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. I don't think people even concept or grasp the idea of positive masculinity. It seems when we talk about masculinity, it is always seeming to be toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. What does positive, emotionally healthy manhood look like in South Africa? Because I think the narrative we have now is just the negative, and that is what most women specifically and men are exposed to.
And let me start by saying that what men are asking a lot of is, can society stop pluralizing men into one monolithic segment? And the idea that masculinity is toxic, because what men are saying is, you know, when Dr. Nandipa does what she does with Bester, and they kill someone or they ban someone and they're in jail, we don't immediately then say all female doctors or all black female doctors are like this. We individuate her Luciferian malevolent act to her. When a policewoman kills 8 family members for policy or life insurance, we don't immediately say all police women or all police femininity is toxic. We take that case and we judge it on its own merits. And what men are also asking is, can we also be judged the same way we accord humanity to a woman who kills their own child? We don't immediately say what is wrong with her. We immediately humanize her and we say, I wonder what happened. I wonder if she was depressed. I wonder if it was postpartum depression. I wonder if we start asking questions first before we make conclusions that all women with babies are killers. So this is the first part that men are genuinely asking for, that can we please not be made objects? Because when you say toxic masculinity, you move a man from being a subject to an object. And objects are easy to throw stones at. You dehumanize the person and you don't humanize the person. So that's the first part. And then the part about what would make a more healthy masculinity. For most of the research actually on this is, can we all accept that men at the core are just humans first, who so happen to be born male? So the first part is, how do you make a whole positive human being, not masculine not feminine or not XY, not XX chromosome or any of the variations in between. How do you make a whole human being who feels they matter, who feels they are loved, who feels that they can contribute to society, they are opportunities? So the first parts are, we need to solve the issue of poverty inequality because it does affect males significantly. We need to solve the issue of lack of employment because it does affect males. So we can't be creating whole healthy masculinity without fixing the structural problems. We need to fix the issue of safety and security because it also kills men. Anything that is negative about masculinity is not only negative to women, girls, and plants and dogs. It's also negative to men. It also kills men as well. So that's the other part. Like then, we just need to be able to be taught at a young age that you can be a whole human being who is pro-social, who is egalitarian, who practices the 12 values which Aristotle talks about, which is kindness, respect, and freedom. All of those virtues and values apply whether you're a woman or a man. Those are core values. I think between men and women, 90% of who we are is actually on values. Socialization should be the same. And then they will differ then biologically on the fact that we are biologically different. But at the core of who we are, 90% plus should be the same. I should respect you, Carol, not any reason because you're a human first, not even because you're a woman. It should be because you are a human who so happens to be a woman called Carol. The same should apply to a man, that I should be respected for being a human being who so happens to be a man called Mzam.
Yeah. There was a time actually when there was a big phrase, hashtag men are trash, trended in South Africa. I think this was probably at the beginning of when the GBV conversation became louder and louder. And at the heart of it was this campaign, hashtag men are trash. I spoke to Dr. Chawani about it, and she spoke about the negative implications of such hashtags, such umbrella slogans. And you've obviously touched on it now about how we, you know, men want to be seen as individuals, even though there are men who do bad things. It shouldn't be that because there's one man who's done a bad thing or a couple of men that have done bad things, that this label men are trash, or as you mentioned, izinja or dinja or whatever the case may be that society uses. How do you think we tackle this in a way that, firstly, as women, feel like the conversation is being heard by men, that we feel not heard? Because I think the disparity happens where women sort of feel like if we don't get agency and say, for example, men are trash and put it in that space, we won't wake up the men that are technically not trash to say enough is enough. If we don't put it that way, it sort of puts the bad guys in one cup and then we must fight them alone. Whereas if we put all of them in one cup, then they all fight each other to make sure that our voice is heard. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah, you're making lots of sense. And I think the first part, we must acknowledge that these painful words that are used have a source, an origin, and that origin is pain and hurt inflicted by men. So, which has gone for a very long time unnoticed or hasn't received restorative justice or punitive justice. And so we must acknowledge that these words were not just used from no source. There is a source, and that source is pain and hurt. And that unrecognized pain and hurt has metastasized into hate speech, into righteous normative violent words or verbal violence, which is men are trash or men must die. That's verbal violence. But it has a source. So we must first acknowledge that and not run away from that. At the same time, we must also acknowledge that when we want to solve something and we use these tactics, they produce unintended negative consequences. And those unintended negative consequences are that they increase conflict, gender conflict and competition, and the love for each other actually begins at the end of our conflict and competition. And they also, what they do what apartheid actually want it to happen, particularly within the black and colored community, is that we remain not united. We remain divided. The disunity creates an even larger gap between black women and black men, colored women, colored men. So what means then that what it means is that apartheid won or continues to win. Because if it doesn't divide us by tribes, Zulus, Xhosas, Sotus, you name it, it divides us now by gender. So it actually produces many unintended long-term consequences of disunity, conflict and competition. And what we also forget is that when two elephants fight, the grass suffers. And in our instance, the grass ends up being the children that we are raising, girls and boys, who end up suffering from our fights. So we need to be reminded that the love for the child begins at the end of our conflict and competition. The love for each other also begins at the end of our conflict and competition. And that the more we compete and conflict as genders, the more child poverty we produce and the more poverty our kids inherit. So I hope we can also lift our heads up and as head as we have been, and we should acknowledge this head, we should find ways to apologize, find ways to seek reparations in order to find the healing. We must also be very careful not to use such easy slogans, but they produce unintended negative consequences in the long run.
And that is such an important aspect to this particular conversation. And we're tackling mental health, especially for men. And that is why I spoke to Dr. Chawane, who really highlighted how a lot of men suffer in silence. For someone who works with your NGO, Africa Men Care, and have written this book, how do you convince men to look at psychological help as a strength over it being a weakness? Because we do realize that this is a space where men are battling to talk to anyone, never mind a psychologist, a professional, their wives, their sisters, their friends, they battle. How do you convince them, knowing what happens when you suffer in silence?
What we've found so far has been working well has been what we'll call group therapy. Instead of sending men alone to a place where he's ill-equipped. For example, in my case, when I was forced to go to therapy at age 23, 24, I was forced by my mentor and coach, whom I loved and respected, and he said, you need to go to therapy. You are angry, you are broken. There's a lot about you that is starting to show up at work, and it will affect how you are seen and perceived at work. And I went, and for 10 sessions, the therapist said to me, you've been here and you haven't used one emotive word. Your words are very functional, they cold, and you can't describe an emotion or feeling. And she had to help me with emotional wheel, where I had to study how to have emotive words, how to express words like sadness and joy and shame, because the only emotive word I understood was anger. And the other emotion, primary emotions and tertiary and secondary emotions, I didn't understand. So I needed to be trained and conscientized. So the first part for me was group therapy, where men gather. Like on Saturday and Sunday, I was at a Father's Day session where over 100 men gathered to talk about issues affecting men. That helps because men feel more open and safe in those spaces. So we create these spaces for men to get used to opening up. The second one is conscientizing men with the vocabulary, because you can't expect a people who are in psychology, we call it alexithymia, where someone is emotionally stunted, that they don't have words to express an emotion, to now go to a therapist who's going to ask a question that says, how do you feel? Or how did it make you feel? Those are not the best questions to ask someone who is still emotionally stunted. And so we now have to conscientize and train and educate men in those group sessions on how to express an emotion, how to feel a feeling, and how to name the feeling. So those are some of the things that we now continue to do. And then over time, then that individual will find and make time to go and see a therapist themselves. But to just push them directly to a therapist without equipping them, conscientizing them, without being in safe spaces with other men, it will be difficult for majority of men. Men are scared of two people. They're scared of a urologist and they're scared of a psychologist. And I mean, a urologist for most men, when you ask them, why don't you go to urologist, especially black men, because they are more prone to prostate cancer than any other race. They will say, I'm scared of the finger up my bum because I'm scared of what I might discover. I'm scared if, what if I like it? I'm scared what it will say about my orientation, sexual orientation. Same with psychologists. They go deep. They go inward. And the men are scared to find their ghosts, to find their shadows, because what do you do with them now that you know them? So those are some of the things I think we take it lightly, that it's a marathon, ultra marathon, not a sprint, to make a man or nudge a man to move towards psychotherapy.
Right. And if you had to look at what a healthy man looks like in 2026, what does a healthy man look like?
He's like any other human being. He is perfectly imperfect. He's flawed. He has shadows and light. He's a saint and a sinner like everyone else, but he owns up to his shadows and he owns up to his light, and that he is not someone who is perfect. He's making progress. He's sometimes just good enough, not great. Not godly or God himself. He's flawed. He like God, he gets angry. Still, he has all the primary emotions that anyone has. But now he knows how to self-regulate. He knows how to, when he is emotionally dysregulated, how to get back to being regulated. He has tools. And he has ways he can use, whether it be mindfulness or breath work, go exercise, don't drink, drink less alcohol, don't smoke, all of these things. Now he has tools and he knows that sleep, quality sleep, is actually amazing medicine for any human being, including a man. And that you don't have to hustle as hard and not sleep because it will damage your brain. All of these things now. It's a man who is conscientized with tools. And he's aware, but he's still going to be like everyone else with light and shadows, perfect and imperfect. And he's still going to be able to demonstrate that he is human. And he has all these primary emotions, but now with tools and now with awareness. That's what I'm ideally looking for. Maybe it sounds idealistic, but that's what I genuinely believe should be the ideal that we seek for.
And if you had to say, who would be the ideal person to read this book?
For me, the first people, of course, is parents with boys and parents who are raising boys, whether it be social parents, whether it be aunts, uncles, grandparents, the mothers and the fathers, and teachers in particular, like educators or psychologists or psychotherapists, who are seeing boys, so that would help. Then the second audience is just allies, people who are really interested in building a society that builds whole girls and whole boys, so that we can create a whole future. So my primary target audience was initially people who are interested in the affairs relating to boys. The other audience was men. And so that men can understand and get a vocabulary that they can use and tools they can use to understand, why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? Why am I behaving the way I'm behaving? How did my adverse childhood effects affect me? And how do they show up and dance now in my adulthood? And what tools and things I can consider to become a better human being?
And, you know, when I spoke to Dr. Chawani, she said that one of the big things she asks men is not why are you angry, but who hurt you? And she says, by asking that question, it unlocks so much and doesn't put blame, but more tries to interrogate where the pain is coming from, because it's a matter of pain, which I found so interesting in understanding just how men are. I think for most women, we want to be support. We want to be a ear. If you could speak to women now who have men, husbands, brothers, colleagues, friends, how do we make ourselves safe space for men to be able to support them? Is it in using language like "who hurt you"? Is it allowing the space in a different way? Because I think we're all trying to make ourselves more empathetic to men's experiences and what they're going through.
Thank you very much. I think the first one for me will be around the finding new words that don't pathologize and problematize men, that don't make men feel like a pathology. And we end the words like "men are trash," "men are useless," or "a man without money is useless or worthless." We just reframe the language, because that's also very important. The same thing we were trying to do, or we continue to do, with the LGBTQAI plus community, persons with disability, neurodivergency, mental health or mental illness. We need to find new words, because words matter a lot, and words can heal and words can hurt. So that's the first part. And then the second one is, if the father is absent and if you have nothing good to say about the father, please say nothing. Rather say nothing. And if you watch your body language when your child comes home and says, "my father is a hero, the absent father who's not paying maintenance," and you roll your eyes and you change your body language, the child is studying that and they can see it. And by the way, in child psychology, when someone says to a child, "your father is useless," the child can't disassociate their identity with the identity of their father. So they are not hearing "my father is useless." They are hearing "me and my father, we are useless." So it's on language for me as well. And then the other thing on language is, we need to move away from "what is wrong with you" to "what happened to you." Because when you start saying "what is wrong with you," you've already problematized the person. They have become an object. When I say to you, "what happened to you, Mzam," it brings more humanity and cognitive empathy into the story. Then the other piece for me is around access to the child. Majority of the fathers, some of them, yes, there are those who are irresponsible, who don't want to see their children, who don't want to take care of their children, pay maintenance. But the majority of some of the fathers we spoke to want to have access to their child, but they've been either blocked by family members because they didn't pay the fine for isisu or intlawulo, or they can't afford maintenance. And we are asking, can we please disaggregate maintenance and access? Because access to a child shouldn't be attached to "you must pay." Same for men. Men must pay maintenance, whether they have been given access to the child or not, because you can't deprive the child of their material well-being because you're saying they are not giving me access. Both parties need to make sure they are acting in the best interest of the child, and they must act in the best interest of the child. That also means what the child wants is access to their father. Whether their father is a drunkard or he's a loser, if people use words like loser, or he has no money, kids don't want money only from their fathers. They want quality time, quality access. And there's enough evidence to prove that kids who are raised by both parents, even if those parents are divorced or separated, not living together, the child's outcomes improved significantly. Kids raised by both parents have an amazing quality outcomes than kids only raised by a single parent. So those are some of the things. And then same with education. We all need to be reflecting hard on education, on how do we make sure that the education system also suits the boy, and that we take into account of his biology. We take into account of the fact that he can't concentrate for 8 hours with all that growing testosterone. So how do we reframe the pedagogy of teaching so with parents involved shaping the education system? And then the other area where we need help and allies with women is how do we bring men back into care and essential jobs? For example, teaching. 90% of teachers now, to be a teacher in this country is to be female. That's also wrong because you need male teachers at primary school, at grade one. You need nurses. 90% of nurses in this country are female. You need nurses in the health sector who are male. Male nurses. Same with psychologists. Over 80% of psychologists are female. You need psychology, male psychologists in this care, very important role, psychiatry, psychologists, nursing, teaching. How do we get help and women ally with us to nudge men to see these care roles and care profession as important, necessary, and also cool? And it doesn't emasculate you. You're not less of a man if you're a nurse. You're not less of a man if you're a psychologist or a primary school teacher. How do we, all of us, including women, not look down on a man who says, I'm a primary school teacher, but actually congratulate him, elevate him. Same if he says, I'm a nurse, and elevate him and congratulate him. Those are some of the things that we can think about or start doing.
You talk about positive role models and having a help with a strong sense of identity and the consequences that ripple through families and communities. What practical role can parents, schools, and society at large do in breaking the cycle? You've mentioned now just care roles be given to men. But what else can we do in the homes? Because some homes are just, there's only women. There are no males that the child can have, you know, relation with. For example, maybe the father's passed on or this relationship is extremely estranged. He's living in a different continent. How do we give boys that balance with positive role models?
You know, I say to people, by the time I was 8 or 9, because I grew up in places with gangsters and drug dealers, inequality, poverty, we started selling drugs. But someone saved my life by taking me to Boy Scouts, by making sure that I'm an altar boy. The most important thing for parents, especially single parents, is to accept that on your own, you are not enough. It is not enough for you alone. It takes a village to raise a child. Same, it takes a village to raise a boy. So the next stage for me is that if there are absent men or there aren't no uncles or men, then take your child to scouts. Take your child to a sports club, a music club, a fashion design club, or any club, whatever your boy child is inclined to do or likes or is passionate about. Chess clubs. Take your child to clubs where there will be other male role models who will act as social fathers, who would act as male role models for your child. In my case, it was the scoutmaster. It was the deacons at church when I was an altar boy, when I was in nonprofits, when I was in sport. It will be the coach. So those now end up being the social fathers that I modeled my being around. I modeled who I want to be using them as positive role models. So there are other places where we can find male role models if they don't exist at home or they don't exist in your street. But the most important thing is you need to keep your boy busy. You need to make sure that your boy's physical playtime is greater than their digital playtime. What that then means is your boy must join clubs. Your boy must get involved in other activities. Your boy must sweat. They must do more physical activity than digital activity. So those are some of the things I feel like sometimes they are actually low-hanging fruits and they are not used enough.
And lastly, your parting shots on this. You've written this very powerful book. What are your last words on this conversation around the way society treats our boys, that in turn is the way we treat our men?
What I wanted to say to society is that gender equality and gender empathy is not a zero-sum game. We can do both. It is end-to-end. We can empower, and we must continue to empower women and girls. It is necessary to do so. And we can also empower boys and men so that we can create a whole, healthy society for both. And I have three daughters. And I want my daughters, when they decide to marry or date, to marry a whole, not broken boy with a broken interiority who now becomes a male or adult male with a broken interiority as I have been in this life. So I'm hoping that as a society, we can make sure that no one is left behind and no boy is left behind. And we continue doing both projects. And I am not advocating for either or. I'm advocating for and, so that we can create a whole boy and a whole girl that also gives us a whole future.
A whole future. Couldn't have said it better. Dr. Nzamo Masito, thank you so much for your time. This is riveting. This is really insightful. And I appreciate the work, and we're looking forward to more books.
Thank you very much.
Carol O'Fori, weekdays 9 a.m. till 12, East Coast Radio.